Campus FM presents a talk organized by the Department of Youth and Community Studies. This talk is delivered by Father Michael Holman and coordinated by Dr. Andrew Atsopardi.
Nilqakom għal outside lectures, l-lum se namlu xi ħaġa tikka żgħira differenti miegħi għandi l-Father Michael Holman, Ġeżwita mill-Ingilterra, se nkun qed nitkellem l-Ingliż naturalment għaliex Father Michael huwa Ingliż u se nkun qed nittrattaw diversi issues marbutin mal-Ġeżwiti u anki mal-Żgħażagħ. So I'm sure you managed to understand what I said in Maltese.
Oh, every single word. Every single word. I can't reply in anything but English, I'm afraid.
Father Michael Holman, first of all, I welcome you to Campus FM. I'm assuming it's your first time at Campus FM Radio.
It is indeed my first time at Campus FM, but not my first time in Malta.
Yes, we've been talking about this offer, and it seems that you've been in Malta quite a number of times.
I have. I had the privilege when I was a boy coming here with my family on holiday. We stayed in St. Julian's Bay, I remember. Mm-hmm. That's all well over 30 years ago. But more recently, I became Jesuit provincial in Britain in 2005. But in 2006, I was here. I made my own retreat at Mount St. Joseph, which I'm sure many of your listeners know. And then I went over to Gozo, to the Jesuit retreat house there, and I directed the retreat for the Maltese Jesuits. Later on that same year, we had a meeting of a smaller group of Jesuit provincials with the Maltese provincial at the time, and that was again at Mount St. Joseph. And then in Holy Week next year, I will come back and I'll be giving some talks at the chaplaincy on the Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday of Holy Week.
The chaplaincy led by Father Michael.
By Father Michael.
Another Father Michael.
Indeed. Michael, who studied in London.
He
studied
really?
In London at our Heathrop College, which is our main school for theology in London.
And I must say that students like him a lot. So anyway, you were in Malta for the conference for European Jesuit Provincials.
That's right.
First of all, what does it mean to be a provincial, and what is the conference about?
Well, a provincial is responsible for the Jesuits and the Jesuit work in a particular area. So take my own case. A geographical area.
Okay.
In my own case, I'm responsible for about 200 Jesuits who work in Britain, but who also work in two other areas which have historic links with the British province of the Jesuits. One is Guyana in South America, mm-hmm. where we work with some of the poorest people, I guess, on this planet. They're Amerindian people who live and work in a subsistence kind of way on the borders of Guyana and northern Brazil. We're also responsible for the work of the Jesuits in South Africa. So the British province is both Britain and these two areas of Guyana and South Africa.
What about the conference?
The conference takes place every year, Andrew. There are about 25, 26 Jesuit provincials in Europe, stretching from Ireland in the west, way over to Russia in the east. And we meet every year, and we meet in a different place every year. This year it's Malta, last year it happened to be Madrid, the previous year it was Gdynia in the north of Poland. I suppose in years gone by, it used to be that a province would be concerned about its own work in its own place, in its own area. But in the last 20 years, certainly, we've been looking at ways in which we can collaborate that much more. So, for example, we have some common works across Europe. The formation of our younger men is a matter which is the responsibility not only of a particular province, but of the European Conference of Provincials as well. We have a European Refugee Office in Brussels, which coordinates the work of the refugee service that the Jesuits have throughout Europe. And we also have another office in Brussels, which looks to lobby the European Parliament on issues that are of real interest to Catholics and Christians in Europe, particularly social issues. We're very keen to do that, especially if we can lobby on behalf of the poorest in society. So there are many common works that we do now. We don't simply work in our own provinces.
Jesuits seem to be in the forefront of very important and delicate issues. In Malta, they are probably the pioneers, the people who lead the agenda. They've done a lot of work. The GRS has done a lot of work in Malta when it comes to immigration and speaking on behalf and advocating for immigrants and for the whole agenda surrounding immigrants.
Yesterday I was privileged, I must say, to visit the Jesuit Refugee Service in Malta, which is based, I think, in the college, at St. Aloysius College. Mm-hmm. And I was with two other provincials from Europe and also three provincials from Africa. And it was just very interesting to meet those who are responsible for JRS Malta, to hear about the kind of work they are doing, which of course is of concern to us all in Europe. Here you are, if you like, on the southern frontier, but this is not just a matter for which you and Malta should be responsible, it's something for which we should all be responsible. And I think provincials from other parts of Europe, we go, we listen to JRS Malta, and we see how we might be able to collaborate in that kind of work. But, you know, you said something generally there about Jesuits. 2 years ago, we had a really interesting meeting in Rome called a General Congregation. It brought Jesuit provincials from all over the world, and we came together to elect a new Superior General, who's actually here with you in Malta at the moment. But one of the things his name is Adolfo Nicolás. Yes, he was a Spaniard.
But he had a Kolumbach.
Previous to him was Father Kolvenbach, Peter Hans Kolvenbach, who was here about 2 years ago.
Okay.
I think he attended the centenary of St. Aloysius College.
Possibly, yeah.
Father Kolvenbach was remarkable. He retired after 24 years at the age of 80. That's a very long period to be in such a position. Father Nicolás is an interesting man. He's from Spain, and he has spent all his life as a priest, at least, so for the last 40 years and more. He was based in the Far East, in Japan in particular, but also more recently he coordinated our work in the Far East from our office in Manila. But you know, we went during that meeting, a general congregation, we went to see the Pope, we went into the Vatican, and we went into the Sala Clementina, a magnificent hall, and in came the Pope, and he spoke to us for about 25 minutes, and he said, "I want you Jesuits to do something that you've always done." He said, "I want you to
get yourself into trouble."
He didn't put it like that. He said, "Go to the frontiers," he said. "Go to the geographical frontiers, like China, like Japan, where we have been going for centuries." But he also said, "Go to those internal frontiers. Go to those frontiers where faith and culture meet." And that frontier is so often very close to home. In fact, I think here in Malta, I think back in Britain, it's a culture that doesn't just exist in our own country, but it goes through each one of us, because we're all part of modern culture, and we all try to live our faith, and we have to bring the two together, and that's a frontier. And he says, "That's where I want you to work too, with the pressing issues of today, with the issues that make it difficult for people to believe today. Go there, help them, work with them."
I am an old Aloysian, and so I'm a bit of a biased presenter at the moment, so because I have had a very good experience with the Jesuits, with Father Paul Ketkuti and Father David Chafai, and loads of others who've been around when the need was probably the strongest. And one of the things that came across continuously was the issue of social justice.
Yes.
Is it still an important...
Very much so, Andrew, very much so indeed. We, in our way of looking at Christianity, strongly believe, along with many, many, many others, of course, that in order to live the life of Christ with integrity, we need to be people who have not just an eye for the poor and not just an ear for the poor, but we need to work amongst the poor. Because we believe, well, Jesus was born in poverty. Because we believe that, well, he chose to preach the kingdom from a position of poverty and with people who were themselves poor. And in preaching the kingdom, he demonstrated that the world was turned upside down, if you like, that the last shall be first and the first shall be last. So to preach this kingdom with integrity, we ourselves need to be where Jesus was, on the side of the poor.
Mm.
And through our works, for example, of education, which is probably still our biggest work throughout the world. Jesuits throughout the world are educating more than 2 million students in universities, in schools like the one you went to, like the one I was once a headmaster of, but also in formal settings. In South America, we have this big network of informal schools known as Fe y Alegría, Faith and Happiness, educating many hundreds of thousands of poor people in the mountains and the savanna grasslands of South America. But wherever we are, we try to live this kind of Christianity. Sometimes it means working with the poorest in poor schools. I visited a school in a slum district of Nairobi. It took my breath away to see the poverty in which people were living there. And it equally took my breath away to see the fine work that our lay organisation, an organisation that's very closely linked with us, the Christian Life Community, were doing for those young people in Kibera, in Nairobi. When we work with the wealthy, which we do at times, we look to inspire them to use their talents and use their gifts and use their resources on behalf of the poorest. That's excellent.
In fact, in Malta we have a very good project being manned by Father Edgar as well when it comes to the Pedro Rupe Institute. So there's lots of
social justice institute.
Social justice. You've mentioned, you actually mentioned the role of the laity. Where does that stand nowadays? How important are lay people to support the Jesuits' work?
Absolutely vital. And I think, you know, over the last 40 years and more since the Second Vatican Council, one of the major works of the Society of Jesus has to been promote that vision that was very much a vision of the Second Vatican Council, in which everyone, by virtue of his or her baptism, has a ministry to perform within the church. And so lay ministry in so many different ways in so many different countries has taken off, and not least in the Society of Jesus. So if I look, for example, at our schools, I'm sure it's the case here in Malta, it was certainly the case back in Britain, we depend largely now on laymen and laywomen who work with us as teachers, but also as principals and deputy principals, people who not only work alongside us, but people who share our vision of education. And much of my time when I was a head teacher, but also much of my time now in provincial, is making sure that there are resources available for those lay people who work with us to develop their understanding of the Jesuit way of being in a school, of being in a parish, of being in a social centre. And often that means providing a background for them, opportunities for them to experience Ignatian spirituality, because that's where, in a sense, it all begins.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know what I'm saying about the Society of Jesus is the case with many, many, many other religious congregations and religious orders here in Malta, in my own country, in Britain, and throughout the world, too. In other words, now we work in collaboration, and in doing that, I believe that we are realizing the vision of the Second Vatican Council of the Church, where ministry is alive and well because we engage in ministry by virtue of our baptism.
You mentioned Ignatian spirituality.
Sure.
It means something to me, but maybe you can explain a bit more on what it's all about. Is it having this famous 40-day retreat and...
30, actually.
30, okay. 30-day retreat, that's right. Every so often and...
Yes.
What is it about?
It is that. I think one of the great indicators of what the Jesuit spirituality can do for someone was given to me in a book I read in Spanish not so long ago, where this author was writing about how Ignatian spirituality enables someone to encounter Christ in the midst of their lives, encounter Christ in their home life, encounter Christ in their church life, certainly, but encounter Christ also in their work life, with the people whom they meet, in the conversations that they have. Christ is to be encountered here. Christ is inviting us here. Christ is inviting us to respond here. So we have a phrase in the Ignatian spirituality, finding God in all things. Another way of putting that is, we have a vision of life that, if you like, enables us to encounter Christ in the midst of life.
It is said that Britain is becoming, people are saying anyway, that Britain is becoming more Catholic.
More Catholic?
Is it true? No, it isn't.
Well,
or is it just Tony Blair becoming Catholic?
Tony Blair's becoming. There was a time, Andrew, when leaders, I think I'm right in saying, of two of our three political parties, the Liberal Democrat Party, Charles Kennedy, the Conservative Party, Ian Duncan Smith, what are we talking about, 5 or 6 years ago, were both Catholics, and there were rumours that Tony Blair was about to become a Catholic, and as you know, his wife and his family have long since been Catholics. When there was also a report in the newspapers, I suppose about 3 or 4 years ago, that, or maybe less than that, that there were more Catholics attending church on
That's
Sunday
right, yeah.
than there were members of the Church of England, and the Catholics perhaps are the largest denomination. I think what's more pressing for me, in fact, is not whether there are more Catholics or not. It's not so much a question of numbers. It's rather the fact, and what saddens me, is our country has become more secularized. Mm. By which I mean that fewer people know of Christ, that young people are growing up without any knowledge of Christ. And I think for me this is sad, because it's not only a point of numbers in church, although going to church is really, really important. It's more the fact that they don't have a relationship with this person who can lead them to the fullness of life, to fulfillment that we all long for one way or another. And so in not knowing about Christ, they're missing out on an awful lot of life.
Whose fault is that?
I'm not sure that it's anybody's fault. I think society has changed. I don't know how you are here in Malta, and I wouldn't begin to comment. But I suppose back in Britain, it is certainly the case that we are now a much more multi-faith, a much more multicultural country, which has brought a great deal of richness to our country. But as part of that movement, as part of a much wider, shall we say, cultural movement, people find it more difficult now to believe in, shall we say, one solution, one answer, one story for everything. It's much more a case, I think, that people recognize that there are different values in different aspects of different cultures and different faiths. Now, clearly, you know, that's something positive in that, but I think it is a pity that in the process people find it more difficult to hear the word of God and to hear the gospel. I definitely think that's a pity.
You have quite an impressive experience. You've worked in Jesuit schools in Glasgow, you've worked at Wimbledon College, you were a headmaster, I need to find that name of the school.
Wimbledon College, is, well, I both worked College there and also was head teacher there,
okay.
Yes, that's right.
So you've been in touch with young people for quite some time.
Yes, that's right. My training, most of my time as a priest, I've been a priest now for over 20 years. Jesuits, as you know, have a very long formation in priesthood. They say that ordination is the reward for a life well spent. So I was ordained at the traditional Jesuit age of the age of 33, so that's about 20 years ago. And most of that time has been spent, apart from being provincial, in schools, working with young people in Glasgow, as you say, where we have a large secondary school. It's co-educational, and in many ways it's very like St. Aloysius. It's your own St. Aloysius. It's a very similar kind of school. But most of my time during those years has been spent at Wimbledon College, which is a different kind of school. It's a state school, so it's supported by the state. It had at its largest, I think, 1,500 boys from age 11 to 18. And because it's supported by the state, they pay no fees at all. And so they came from a wide variety of backgrounds. It's situated in Wimbledon, which for most of your listeners will be associated with tennis, absolutely. And the highlight of the boys' career there was often to be ball boys at Wimbledon. So they were one of many schools that were chosen to be ball boys at Wimbledon tennis. So they had some very wealthy youngsters who came to that school because it is a wealthier part of London, but they also had some youngsters who were significantly disadvantaged. And it was a great privilege to be able to work with so many youngsters from so many different backgrounds for so long. So
you have been involved with young people for quite some time.
Oh yes, indeed, and in different ways, chaplain, teacher, and also head teacher.
How would you define youth?
How would I define youth? I think there is, I think anyone who works with youth will probably agree, I hope they will agree, that it is always an exciting job. It is always a job of, makes you an optimist in life, because you see a great deal of good, a great deal of good. I think a lot of youngsters back in London, which is, as you know, a huge city of whatever it is, 10 million people, what are about 40 kilometres across and 40 kilometres from top to bottom, which has all the urban challenges that you would expect in a highly industrialised society. Life can be very confusing for them, and life can be very difficult for them. A number of the youngsters whom I taught came from single-parent families, for example. A number of them came from families where, if they had both parents, then both parents were working and had to work extremely hard to maintain a certain level of life. So life can be quite tough for youngsters. I think what makes life particularly tough for youngsters in Britain is that they're often the object of advertising. You know, they're often the object of this consumer society, which is now a main theme in our culture in Britain. Of course it is, as it may be here in Malta. Which means that they're taught again and again and again that the purpose of life is to have more, or the purpose of life is to look like some film star, or to wear particular clothes that are advertised by, I don't know, David Beckham or whoever it might be. So life is particularly confusing, but you know, in the midst of that, I think they show great respect for one another, they show great toleration for one another, and also I think they are legitimately concerned about the poorest in society, and particularly those poorest areas of our world, to which they will, you know, if they can, contribute very generously with their time, and sometimes with their money too, but also with their time and their interest.
You had this what seems to be a quite an important experience in your life.
Oh yes.
Quite an important experience, the Michael experience.
Yes.
Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, I remember Michael was a student at Wimbledon College from the age of 11 until the age of 16. And he was a bright-eyed boy. He came from an Irish family, had a big smile from ear to ear. He was a lad who was often in trouble. There were some troubles in his home life, and he didn't shine academically, but he was a youngster about who we were bothered a lot, because we think it is important to help those youngsters who have difficulties in schools, be they behavioural difficulties, which may have been his case from time to time, or be they academic difficulties, and sometimes the two go together. Well, he left school at the age of 16, and then I can remember once I was coming back to my home in Wimbledon when I was headmaster still, and it was a Saturday evening, as I recall, and there was a message for me: could I ring Father so-and-so in a local parish? So I rang Father so-and-so in a local parish, and he said that the parents of Michael, they'd like you to get in touch. And I said, sure, no problem. Well, why? Because this was kind of an unusually urgent request. And he said, well, a terrible thing happened last night. Michael was stabbed, and he was stabbed to death in a quiet and quite prosperous suburb of London, not too far from his home. So that was a very shocking experience, and it was a very upsetting experience, certainly very upsetting for all those who knew Michael, me included, but above all, of course, for his parents. And I later conducted his funeral. There was, of course, an inquest after an autopsy, and so things didn't move exactly quickly. So about 4 weeks after his death, we had his funeral. I can remember a packed church full of his friends, and I learnt quite a lot about Michael in the meantime, that he had been one of a number of youngsters who had been living at home but not living at home. In the summer months, they might be, shall we say, living in the parks of South London. They may be drinking, they may be, I don't know, sometimes doing graffiti or whatever. Sometimes one would have to say that they were kind of lost youngsters. But nonetheless, they turned up for his funeral. I got to talk to a few of them. And, well, they may have or may not have been lost, but they were certainly very engaging young people who all had a story to tell. And, you know, I just wish that we had more time to work in and amongst them. So Michael set me thinking a great deal about young people in growing up in London. And what particularly, a year or two ago, put me in mind of him was the fact that, as many of your listeners may know, in London at that time we had a large number of youngsters who were murdered on the streets, often by other teenagers, and more often than not, in knife attacks. And this was a matter of great concern to the people of London a couple of years ago. It still is, although thankfully the statistics are a lot better than they were in that particular year, when I think some 30 or more youngsters lost their lives on the streets of London violently.
But what does this represent? Why? A very simplistic question possibly, but why does it happen? Because stabbing somebody is probably more difficult than shooting somebody, I would say. I mean, I don't know, but you know, stabbing is you know, there has to be direct contact. It is. What do you think? What do you make of it?
A lot of knives apparently were at that time and still are being carried around by young people. In a sense, it's a vicious circle. the fact that some youngsters are known to carry knives makes more youngsters carry knives, because they think that, well, if they're going to be confronted late at night, or not so late at night, by a youngster carrying a knife, they ought to have some weapon with which to defend themselves. And so the situation, if you like, worsens that way. And clearly there's a vicious circle there that the government has tried to break by, for example, giving the police powers of stop and search, by, for example, installing metal detectors at underground stations or whatever, in order to try and find out which youngsters are carrying weapons, and of course also, at the same time, by increasing the sentence that young people will get if they carry weapons. But I suppose you're asking, why is it they ever get into this situation in the first place? I think it does have to be said that, unfortunately, there are a lot of youngsters who are lost in our country as well as in other countries, but it is also the case in our country. There was a survey that was carried out about 3 or 4 years ago by the Organization of Developed Countries in Europe. And they did a survey of well-being of youngsters. It was a university statistics survey, and they took 6 particular indicators of youngsters and youngsters' well-being, and they did a survey amongst the 21 most developed countries of Europe, and they discovered, on, at least on these measures, that youngsters in Britain, their well-being was the lowest of all, whereas youngsters, I think, in the Netherlands, they were the best of all, if you like, in terms of well-being. And it didn't seem to be, clearly, a correlation between the wealth of a country and the well-being of youngsters. It seemed that there were other factors involved. And a particular factor that came out in the British discussion of this particular survey, which was very, a cause of great concern to many, was that young people in Britain seem to be formed by their peers much more than in other countries, where they are formed more consistently by adults, by significant adults. And that seems to be something to do then with their patterns of behavior. They're being shaped more by their peers than by significant adults.
Why do you think we interpret youth and young people as a subculture that is abusive, it is disinterested, it does not contribute to society? Is this true, or?
I think inevitably there are young people who are of that kind, and you know they're always the ones, I suppose, that catch the headlines, aren't they? But my experience of young people is that by no means are all like that. The majority, I think, are very tolerant youngsters, they are very respectful youngsters, and they're looking to make the most of their lives. And when they look at the most of their lives, I think they are more generous and more outward looking than, say, my generation was. It's part of the globalized economy, it's part of the globalized, you say, information network, that they know much more about what's going on in other parts of the world. They regard these young people that they see in other parts of the world as their brothers and sisters, and they're very keen to do something about it. I don't know how it is here in Malta, but in Britain, a lot of youngsters take gap years. They go out from Britain, say before they go to university or just after they finished university, and they want to go out and experience other cultures, particularly those who are suffering in other cultures, and make a difference for them. And I think that's really positive. Now, I think therefore we have to be very careful about stereotyping. And I think that there is far more good news about young people than there is, shall we say, news that disturbs us. But there is a significant group, a significant minority perhaps, that seems to be losing out.
What is the, young people's stance on religion? Where do they stand with organized religion?
We have
talked a bit about this, but maybe specifically to the younger generation.
Sure. Well, I think it is the case, undoubtedly in Britain, that once young people are confirmed, and they are confirmed in Britain usually at the age of 13 or 14, it does vary considerably from diocese to diocese. It is often the case that you will find in parishes that the majority lose touch with the Catholic Church. Unfortunately, that they lose touch with regular practice. Of course, there are many exceptions. But one of our great challenges in Britain and in the church in Britain is to reach out to young people of teenage years and of young adult years. Undoubtedly, that is the case.
Is it because, I don't know, hypothetically, it's because the church is possibly too big, too impersonal? And so young people need the sense of belonging which they may not find. Is it possibly because the church's methods are not the medium used to reach out to people is still maybe the old-fashioned medium? And
It's rarely old-fashioned. I mean, in Britain, I think, since the Vatican Council, a great deal of change has been made in the style of liturgy, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I think great attempts have been made to develop youth liturgies, family liturgies. I think also a number of parishes, though not as many as perhaps many of us would like, now have youth ministers. Many of these are volunteers. Some of them are, shall we say, paid and hired, and in a very professional kind of way they are trained as well. I think there are many pressures upon young people's time. I think the fact that, in my country at least, Sundays are days when you can shop for not quite as long as you can on other days, but nonetheless you can go shopping, where football takes place. I'm sure you probably have Premier League football here in Malta. Mm-hmm. You see that happening on Sundays as much as it does on Saturdays.
We don't have sellout crowds, but...
You don't have sellout crowds, no. But, you know, there are lots of other attractions. But also it's something to do with the culture in which these youngsters are growing up. It is largely not a culture where, shall we say, they get an instinct for things of faith, where they get an instinct for things of religion. It's a culture in which consumerism predominates. It's a culture in which they are encouraged to get all sorts of experiences of work so that they can themselves become people who participate in the consumer market. It's a culture which is very much to do with the immediate rather than a culture that looks at values, a culture which raises, shall we say, an awareness of the bigger questions of life. I think there's much in our culture that hides those bigger questions of life. And after all, I think we all know that an experience, shall we say, the death of a parent, it's that kind of experience, or the birth of a child, that really puts us in touch with that area of life where religion begins to speak, and begins to speak meaningfully to us. But for youngsters, particularly teenager years, there's so many other things to get involved in, and they're involved in a culture which often doesn't give them an ear for the gospel. And that's quite a challenging culture in which to work. It's one of those frontier cultures that the Holy Father asks us to get involved with.
Can you see elements of young people being disillusioned, keeping in mind that most of the wars we have seen and are seeing around us are wars that somehow have a relationship, either directly or indirectly, with religion, and possibly... The argument comes that I wouldn't want to be involved with Christianity or Islam because all they are representing at the moment.
I think it's both and. I think we have seen that in Britain with the internal disturbances that took place for so long. You can call it an internal war in the north of Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
Where you had two groups, one of which was associated with the Catholic members of that society, another with the Protestant members of that society. And, you know, people will point to the wars in Afghanistan and, of course, in Iraq. And in both those wars, British troops have been involved. And in both those wars, there have been quite high casualties. And again, we see on our television the coffins draped in flags, and they're coming back from having fought in a war that seems, to some at least, to have a religious overtone. Though for others, of course, they recognize, be it in those countries or in Northern Ireland, there are many, many deeper issues at stake. But you see, the other side, Andrew, is there is a great interest in things of spirituality in our country, a great interest indeed. In my own operation, the Society of Jesus, about 4 years ago, we launched an online prayer service called Pray As You Go. And on December the 3rd, we're having a celebration in our central London church that we run, which is going to mark the 12 millionth download of those prayer services, which are styled in a particular way to suit young adult audiences. So there is definitely an interest, and we see it again and again. There was a television program, I don't know whether it was screened here in Malta. If it wasn't, then it's really worth screening, perhaps here in the chaplaincy, wherever, called The Monastery, where five men, were chosen to go and live in a Benedictine monastery just south of London for 5 or 6 weeks. And this television program was a fly-on-the-wall documentary. And they saw them interacting with monastic life, with the monks themselves.
Reality TV.
Reality TV with the monks, you know. And this program had an audience of many millions. There is a real interest. I don't know, you've probably heard of this book by a man called Richard Dawkins. He's a professor at Oxford and an atheist professor. He wrote a book called The God Delusion. And it was many, 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 many arguments for not believing in God. And of course, he'd sold millions of copies. But what that book has done, it has stirred up an interest in religion amongst many people in my country, and not least among young adults. So there is an interest in religion, there is an interest in spirituality, but it's the challenge of people like me to work with these people who have a real interest and try and help them to see that by participating in the life of a community, by encountering Christ in a liturgy, hearing his word, sharing his presence sacramentally, there is something, a ritual there, that gives a meaning and a purpose to life that they cannot find, I think, in any other department of life. Mm. That's a real challenge.
Young people want to be more involved in community life. Would you agree?
Oh, definitely, yes. They're looking for. I think it's possibly true from my observations that young people in my country are possibly more individualistic than they are in other countries of mainland Europe. I could say France and Spain, and from what I know of here in Malta too. But even in my country, there are definite desires to participate in community activities, yes, yes. For example, there's a wonderful man, Jean Vanier, a French-Canadian, and the work he does with handicapped people in the L'Arche communities. And a number of youngsters are very keen on participating in that kind of experience.
We've had a number of young people who've been to Paris and Italy. Yeah, absolutely. We have a community home which sort of resembles it. It is not a proper Jean Vanier model, but it comes very close.
But I know that from Malta, from the youth work that the Jesuits do here in Malta, you go to Cairo, is it, and do various works there as a group.
Cairo,
and
Egypt,
I think the fact that you go as a group and get involved with a community in Egypt. We have a similar project in the school I ran in Wimbledon. We had a similar project where my nephew has just been this past year in Karnataka region of southern India near Bangalore, where they work with the Dalit people, used to be known as untouchables, and they're building a school. And they're working with the youngsters, and this shatters, I think, many of their ideas about what life is about. You can be happy without having all the products that we're told that we need in order to be happy. And that the community experience in that is so important.
Is technology working to the advantage of young people?
I think in many cases it is. I think so. I have to say, as a head teacher, when I was a head teacher of a school in London, of course, that the advances in technology were undoubtedly benefiting education. I think learning about history or physics or whatever it might be, anything in between, through the medium of information technology, using the resources that are available on the internet, some of which, of course, one would not for a minute want young people to be exposed to, but most of which one would, I think this is developing young people's education remarkably well. Yes, I would say that's a great advantage. And also the world is shrinking and there are advantages to that as well. But I will say as well that there are numerous ways in which young people are and have been exploited through modern technology, and not least through the internet. And I'm sure here and also back home we have many examples of ways in which that is happening through chat rooms, etc.
We often hear that young people are possibly disillusioned with institutions. Maybe we can see this in particular with politics. They seem to have a bit of a problem with this particular institution. What is going to happen? What do you envisage will be happening when these young people will be leading our society, and they have been brought up, or they have brought themselves up with a bit of a skepticism towards politics, when politics is such an important yes. components.
I think they're right to be sceptical about politics. Mm. You may have seen that in Westminster, in the Parliament at Westminster, there have been a number of, well, one must say, scandals related to MPs, members of Parliament's expenses. And many MPs have been told to pay back not inconsiderable sums of money. And this has led people to think that members of Parliament whom one thought entered Parliament for public benefit are also using that position for their own individual benefit. And this has caused a certain amount of scepticism amongst not just young people, but older people too, into the value of a most important institution, most important institution. But again, you see, I think these experiences are possibly, at least in this sense, beneficial. I think we live in a much more open society now, where these kinds of issues are open for everybody to see. Whereas in the past, I think there was a great deal of cover-up of these things. Now, if we can learn from this, and if we can look to our Parliament, shall we say, and say, well, we can reform this, we can change this, and we need to do it, and you get people coming into Parliament with that kind of mindset, then it's a future that is brighter than the present. And I think the Church as well. I am optimistic for the Church. I don't think that the present situation that we do have of a number of young people not being so interested in the Church is necessarily going to continue at all. What I said earlier, namely that young people are interested in spirituality, their interest, I think, in work for the poor, this, I think, will lead to a return to the Church for them and for others as the years proceed. I think, you know, things go up and down. They come round again. Mm. It isn't necessarily going to proceed along the same lines. Things go in cycles.
It's very difficult to know, as a Jesuit, what's going to happen with where you're going to be placed, what's going to happen, what is going to be
in my own life.
In your own life,
I know,
yeah.
I know.
So
it's true.
What are your plans, or what
my
are
plans.
The plans for you, rather?
For me personally?
Yes.
Right. Well, I've been provincial for 5 years, and we have a 6-year term.
Okay.
So I have a little, well, about a year and a half to go, I suppose. This is my 5th year. The ideal of a Jesuit is illustrated by our greatest Jesuit saint, St. Francis Xavier. Many people are called Xavier, of course, and many churches are dedicated to St. Francis Xavier. The story is that St. Ignatius was asked by the Holy Father at the time to send missionaries to India, where the Portuguese were beginning colonies, etc., and he looked to one or two men, and they weren't available. And he looked to Francis Xavier, who was then his secretary, his great friends, Francis Xavier, and Francis Xavier said, send me, I'm available. So off he went within 24 hours, trekked over Italy and then across the Alps and then down through Spain to Portugal and eventually took a boat and never returned. So in a sense, that availability, that freedom to go where the need is greatest, is exactly what Jesuits are about. It's the gift that many Jesuits are given, and in my time as provincial, I've seen that in many of my men today, not 400 years ago. So that's what I would hope to be, available for the mission of the society to go where the need is greatest, either in my own province or to go elsewhere. I suspect in my own province, because most of us do work in our own provinces. But, you know, I'm very impressed with a man who left the job of being a head teacher of a school in Germany, and he went to Kosovo, and he started a school there in a place where there had been a huge amount of suffering, a great deal of fighting between the Christians and the Muslims, and he started a school there that is for both Christians and for Muslims. Now, that's a great vision of what our society might be like, where something we don't altogether believe, namely that Christians and Muslims are able to live and work together, is modelled for the rest of society. Now, that's availability, and I admire that man very much. And if I could do something like that, I would be delighted. But it's probably going to be something more humdrum.
You are in that position where you shift people around, no?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How does it work? I mean, how
well, the Jesuit
you know,
thing is
because,
very interesting.
At times, I don't know if enough consideration is taken when Jesuits are shifted around. Not for the Jesuits themselves,
right.
But for the people that they are working with. They've developed certain relationships, they've developed a sense of community, etc., etc., and all of a sudden they find themselves
that's
that
right.
They've developed something and they're off to the next thing. And I think that frustrates people, and possibly, maybe, that is why a number of Jesuits, like other priests and other people coming from the areas, decide to leave.
It does happen, yes. Yes, Jesuits as well as others do.
Because attachment is a very important element in an individual's life.
Yes, it is. It is. It is. It is. Well, you know, when I move someone from place to place, there are a number of things I have to consider. One aspect is, of course, the need of the work. And sometimes the need of the work means that a man should stay, and sometimes the need of the work clearly is, well, he's done good work for 5 or 6 years, 7 or 8 years, maybe sometimes longer. It's good for that work that they have a change. Of course, that's the case sometimes. But also what I have to do is I need to consider the needs of that individual man. And so every year, most of my work as a Jesuit provincial is taken up by visiting the communities. I have about 20 communities in Britain, and also I visit, but in a less direct way, in Guyana and South Africa. But most of my time is travelling around Britain, and I spend about an hour, maybe sometimes more, talking to all the men, be they the oldest in the province, who may be 95, or the youngest in the province, who may be 25. And I listen to him, I listen to how his life is, I listen to how his prayer is. I listen to what are the challenges in his life, personal life, and also his apostolic life, his studies maybe. And together what we try and do is listen for where the Lord is calling him in his life. And I need to pay attention to that also when I move a man or consider moving a man from place to place. So it's a complicated process. But ultimately, I am impressed again and again, Andrew, by the fact that a Jesuit will say, I like working here. People seem to get on well with me, and I get on well with people. We're doing this, we're doing that, we've got plans for the future. But you know that the bottom line is that I want to do what the church needs me to do. And I am so impressed by that. I had a particular case of needing to find the superior of our men in Guyana. And I remember going to a man, and I said, would you do it? And he'd had very little notice of this, and he'd only visited that faraway country once. And he said, if that's what you want me to do, I will do it. So Francis Xavier lives today, not just 400 years ago. But I do take your point. It is often a great challenge. I know when I left Wimbledon, after 9 years as headmaster, and I was previously 3 years as chaplain, it was a big wrench for me. I felt I lost some of my life. So what do? I take that to the Lord, and I ask, say, Lord, this is where I am. In many ways, I would like to stay in this place, but this is where I am. Please help me in this situation to move forward. Please show me the way. And he does. And so he shows me the opportunities in my new work.
But I can understand that the Lord says that to you for your life. What, yeah. I can't really sort of understand how he says it to you for another 200 people's lives. No, I think assurance do you have that the decision has been a good decision?
Well, you're right. Absolutely. It's not just for me to say. It is very much in the context of conversation. I think this is one of the things that St. Ignatius discovered 500 years ago, 400 years ago. He discovered that the Lord is to be found mutuality in conversation. He had a great belief in that. I think the fundamental way of Jesuit working is through conversation, spiritual exercises. Our spirituality is conversational. Much of the work your chaplains will do here is all to do with conversation. And it's the same with the provincial. It's through a conversation. Ultimately, I have made mistakes. Definitely I have made mistakes in moving someone to something that didn't work out. Absolutely. So then what we have to do is face that. And I have to face that. He faces that. And sometimes it takes two shots at the target before we get there. I have to say I made mistakes, of course. But often enough, from some unlikely appointments, we get some very good work happening. So I will say that too.
Father Michael Holman, Jesuit, provincial of Britain, and the other two areas are?
Guyana in South America, including the holiday island of Barbados.
I always thought Jesuits were very smart, so I was trying to find a catch with the
And the other is South Africa. And also we have close connections with a very troubled country, Zimbabwe, where we used to work a lot in Zimbabwe, but now an independent province.
Thank you very much. I hope you have a good stay.
I
hope you have a good work, a good conference whilst you are in Malta.
Andrew, thanks very much. I hope we meet again. Thank you very much. God bless. Bye-bye.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the Department of Youth and Community Studies. This talk was delivered by Father Michael Holman and coordinated by Dr. Andrew Atsopardi.